Greetings, my name is Yitzchak Et Shalom, and it is my honor and pleasure to study Megillat Ruth, the Book of Ruth, together with you via these podcasts. The podcast you are about to hear was originally recorded and sent out via the internet in the year 2007. It is now being resent so that in this series we will complete our study of Megillat Ruth from chapter 1 through the end of chapter 4. I hope that you enjoy, and may we continue to grow in our study of Torah together.
Greetings, and welcome back to our continued series on Megillat Ruth. In the last session, which was the first podcast of Megillat Ruth, I introduced the Book of Ruth, discussed the custom of reading it on the Festival of Shavuot. We studied the first six verses, the exposition of the book, which introduced the various characters who will play a central role in the book, except for two who will appear later. And we are prepared to begin now with the development of the story, beginning on verse 7, Pasuk Zayin. In verse 6, Naomi is reported as to having returned with her daughters-in-law. However, that is really a, sort of a general statement, and the rest of the chapter is devoted to the details of, the, of that return. So she left, and again it's she, not they. She left from the place that she was at. And her two daughters-in-law with her. And again, as we saw in the first podcast, in verse 1 and verse 1 and 2 versus verse 3, the shift of centrality is noted. That in the first two verses, the central character is Elimelech. And in, by, from the third verse, the central character is Naomi. Naomi remains the central character, for the daughters-in-law are always accompanying her, which of course is natural in this case, because she's the one going back. Nonetheless, it is telling. And they went on the way to return to the land of Yehuda. As I mentioned in the last podcast, the key word in this chapter is lashu. And when we finish the chapter, which will be in the next podcast, we will look at the various ways in which lashuv, to return, is used. It demonstrates the tension between, for these girls, between returning home from being with Naomi and returning with Naomi to Yehuda. And associated with the next podcast, I'll have a link to a chart that will also show how that plays out in the chapter. Now. At that, to this point, they're returning. And so far, every indication we have is we do not know why they're returning, but Naomi seems to be sanguine about this potential fellowship and is prepared to take them along. Such an illusion is immediately shattered in verse 8. Vatomer Naomi l'shtei chaloteha. So she says to her two daughters-in-law, Lechna shovna isha levet ima. Literally, go and return each woman to her mother's house. Now, when we saw that the two girls went with Naomi, as I mentioned a second ago, we're not sure why. So one might argue, perhaps they were orphans. And if they were orphans, then they would have nobody left in their lives, so they would stick to the one person who they were connected with, which is Naomi. That supposition is immediately shot down with this verse, where Naomi says to her, go back to your mother's house. It's kind of difficult to think that she meant it poetically as opposed to realistically, because what is she telling them to go back to? This, by the way, raises a much larger question that affects this entire interaction, which will come to an explicit mention, when we look at verse 15, which is there is a general assumption that Ruth and Orpah had converted at some point, before they married Mahlon v'Chilion. There is no way that Elimelech would allow his sons to marry daughters who had not converted. But if that's the case, then how could Naomi possibly be pushing them back to go to return to their nation, which would mean back to their culture and back to their religion? And we'll see that explicit in verse 15. Something to file away and think about. In any case, she turns to them and says, go back to each of you to your mother's house. This was an awkward phrase. Because normally, in the ancient world, many parts of the world till today, the house is associated with the father. So she should have said, every one of you go back to your father's house. Now, it is certainly possible to argue that in each case the father was not alive, and so they were only going to be going back to their mother, but nonetheless it would still be called the father's house even if the father wasn't alive anymore. There are several indications of that in Tanakh. I believe that what's happening here is that Naomi is saying, go back each of you to your mother, as if to say, I'm not your mother. You have a mother, go back to your mother, that's not me. And whether she's saying it because she's chastising them for, shall we say, inappropriate loyalty or a poor priority system, where they are prioritizing a woman who's been in their life for a number of years over their own mothers and willing to leave their home, or whether she's saying, I'm not going to take responsibility for you, you have your mothers, go to them. Either way, that is the phrase that she's using. You have to keep in mind how old these girls are. They're not girls anymore. They were married for 10 years, at least, meaning they were married for 10 years, and then their husbands died, and then the famine was over. We don't know if the famine was over immediately, but we'll give it 10 years. That's the smallest amount of time we could give, which means that they are probably in their mid-20s, because in the ancient world, as is the case even today in many parts of the world, women get married at the onset of puberty, which is around 12 or 13, which means that 10 years later they're in their early or mid-20s. And she's saying to them, go back to your mother's house. Now, there's more to her wish. Ya'as Adonai imachem chesed, and this is something that is prevalent throughout Megillat Rut, is that people are always wishing each other good things and always invoking God's name in that wish. God's name, as I mentioned in the first podcast, is very, very frequently found on people's lips in blessing each other, and yet God's presence is not felt except in the previous verse where it says that God blessed his people and gave them bread. Ya'as Adonai imachem chesed, God should do kindness with you, kasher asitem imam mitim ve'imadi, as you did with the dead and with me. Now Naomi at this point says that you deserve kind things to happen to you. God should treat you kindly in recompense for the kindness that you showed to me and to the dead. Who are the dead? So the simplest read of it is, because she says in the plural, hametim, is a reference to their husbands. But what was the kindness that they showed their husbands? In other words, marrying them? Is that something we would consider a kindness? Well, later on in the text we will find that Boaz says that to Ruth, that marrying him would be a kindness. But in his case, it may be the case because he's an older man. We don't know that that was the case here. Perhaps the kindness that they showed for the dead was burying them or remaining with their mother after they were dead. Although, why is that a kindness to the dead? Unless perhaps the dead are not their husbands. Perhaps the dead is someone else, and we will discover that identity later on, really only at the end of the Sefer book. In any case, she continues on, and she says that God should do this kindness, and she continues on to say what the kindness would be. Yitein Adonai lachem, God should grant you, u'metzena minucha isha beit isha. Before we had isha beit ima, every woman to her mother's house, and now she's wishing them that they should find respite, minucha, and that word will come back to us at the beginning of chapter 3 in spades. You should find respite, each woman, in her husband's house. In other words, she's telling them to go back to their mother's house and wishing for them that God will bless them, that they will be able to get married. No easy feat for a woman who was married to a foreigner from Yehuda, and who was widowed, who was already at the advanced age, if you will, of mid-20s, and never had children. She has a lot of strikes against her in the ancient world. So Naomi's giving this bracha, this blessing, she should be successful. Parenthetically, that may be another reason that the girls were willing to get up and leave, because it's very possible that they were considered as outcasts in Moabite society for marrying these boys from Yehuda. Possible. In any case, that's what she wishes them, and that is her first speech. This, by the way, of course, is the first dialogue in the entire book, a book which has much dialogues, but chiefly it's dialogue. Batishaklahen, and what did she do? She kissed them. What sort of kiss was this? This was a kiss of farewell. That's very clear. Batisana kolan vativkana, and they raised their voices and they wept. So in other words, Naomi is walking with the two girls. The two girls are escorting her. She turns around and she gives them a blessing, which is beautiful, and almost as if she is assuming that they're escorting her simply for a part of the way. turns around, gives them a beautiful blessing, wishes them that they will be successful in finding husbands and they'll be happy with them, and stops there, kisses them, almost as a matter of fact, that they're going to be leaving, and they weep. Vatomarnala. And what is their response? Ki itach nashuv liyamech. Now, the word ki, which normally is translated as because, has many, many meanings. And in this case, it's clear from context that the word ki means rather. In other words, we are rejecting what you're saying. Rather, we will return with you to your nation. Which, of course, goes back to that very pregnant word, lashuv, how it's being used here in a bizarre sense, that we will return to a place we've never been to. We're going to join you in your return. That's what they're saying. So now, there is a tone of obstinance. Naomi has already turned to them and said, I'm wishing for you to go back, and I'm going to go on my own way. And they said, no, rather we're going to go with you. And we don't know how Naomi's going to react. Naomi may react with great joy and surprise and say, that's beautiful, thank you for joining me. We don't know what's going to happen. Let's see. We'll be surprised. Atomer Naomi, shov navnotai. Now, the term of endearment that she uses is more intense. Beforehand, she never called them daughters, and the text refers them to them as daughters-in-law, even though they really are technically no longer daughters-in-law. Now she turns to them, even though in the previous dialogue she said, and the previous words or phrase that she used, she said, go back to your mother's house, and as I suggested, which means I'm not your mother. Now she says, go back, my daughters. Of course, daughters here is used colloquially, and not in any genetic sense. Nonetheless, return, my daughters. Lama telachna imi. Why would you go with me? And she now throws a supposition out, which may reflect what she really thinks they've got in mind. Or maybe she's turning things around and saying, this could be the only possible reason you'd want to come with me, and it's crazy. What did she say? Ha'od li vanim b'me'ai. Do I have more children in my womb? Vayulachem lanashim. I have more sons in my womb that they would be your husbands. In other words, Naomi is taking us back to the 38th chapter of Bereshit, 38th chapter of Genesis, the story of Tamar and Yehuda's sons, and eventually Yehuda's, if you will, other sons who will become progenitors of David, which of course is the end of the story. And it is a story that is explicitly invoked towards the end of chapter 4. And that is the story of Tamar, who marries Yehuda's son, Judah's son, Er. Er dies, Tamar is childless. Onan is asked to perform a levered marriage, a yibum, by his father. And he refuses to do so and has coitus interruptus, and God kills him also. And so Tamar is a suspected woman. In other words, Judah thinks that Tamar may be the cause of their death. And he sends her away, promising her the third son, Shelah, when he becomes of age, but having no intention of actually letting Shelah getting anywhere near her. In the end, she ends up finding a way to have relations with Yehuda himself, and that, of course, becomes one of the lines that leads to David. Now, that seems to be what Naomi is throwing onto the girls. In other words, you girls are so committed to the family that you're going to wait for me to have sons, and those sons will grow up, and you'll have relations with them and have children through them to keep the family name alive. Don't do that. Now, we don't have any reason to think that that's what they had in mind. And that's what she is reflecting back to them. She says as follows. Ha'od livanim b'me'ai v'ayu lachem l'anashim. And she continues. Shov navnotai lechna. Go back. Return, go back. Why? Ki zakanti miot l'ish. She continues on the same theme. She says, I'm too old to be with a man. Now, that is easily interpreted in two different ways. One way would be, I am too old, meaning no man is going to find me appealing. And indeed, she has many strikes against her. She's a widow. She's got these two foreign daughters-in-law who are staying with her. Her son's married out, or however you want to argue it. And along with that, she is somebody of no means, as we will see later on in the story. The second explanation, which is more to the point, is zakanti miot l'ish, meaning I'm too old to be with a man and have children. Because I could get married, but I wouldn't be able to have children. Ki'amarti yesh li tikva. And then she says, all right, let's play the fantasy game. Even if I would have hope. Gam hayiti alay lo l'ish. Even if tonight I would be with a man. V'gam yalad tivanim. And even though I would have sons. And she's imagining the most fantastic scenario possible. Here I am on the road. Let's say tonight I was to be with a man and become pregnant and have twins. Let's even say that. That would mean that you're going to stick around now for countless years to wait for those twins to grow up, those boys to grow up, and to marry them. And she now uses a phrase that in contemporary times is very, very powerful. And she says as follows, Halahenta submerna, would you wait for them? Arashe yigdalu, till they are of age? Halahente agena, would you be anchored to them? And that is, of course, where the phrase, which shows up already in rabbinic literature, of an aguna, a chained woman. But it comes from this verse. Halahente agena, would you be chained to them? Levultia yot leish, not to marry a man. In other words, technically, according to the law, you're free women. Because, according to the law, if a woman's husband dies and leaves her childless, and there is a brother, so she is connected to the brother. If there's no brother alive, that's it. She's a free woman. So what, are you going to sit around and wait for me to have more children and marry them? And by the way, technically, according to the law, those children would not be allowed to marry them. Because they would have a din of Eshet Achiv Shelo Haya Ba'olamot. Remember, a man's brother is not allowed to sleep with his wife even after the brother dies, except in cases where the Torah commands it, such as when there were no children. But that's only brother that was alive at the same time that the original brother was alive. Here, in this fantasy that she's playing out, she's saying, even if tonight I would be with a child, be with a man, and have children, everything else, would you wait for them? Well, of course, according to the law, they would never be able to be with those boys because they are brothers of their husbands who were not around in the same time as their husbands were around. That is a tangent which is significant within the halachic world of Yibum, but not for our story. In any case, she continues, she says, Al benotai. Now, Al, most people understand it being Al, no. Just don't. Al. But some interpret Al as being Alalai, a short form of the word like woe and alas. Alalai benotai, Al benotai. And now she introduces an entirely new theme and a frame of reference or a sort of a mood, if you will, that we have not heard from her before, but it will continue through the end of the chapter. Naomi is portrayed at the beginning of this book as somebody who resembles in a less intense fashion, a male character in Tanakh, to the point where she could be called the female equivalent of that male character. Here's a woman who starts out with wealth, as we find out later, with a husband and children, and suddenly there's a famine, and suddenly she loses everything. And her sons marry, and then her sons die. And she's left with nothing. No money, no family, no progeny, nothing. And now she starts to bemoan her fate. Marli miod mikem, I'm very embittered, and we'll talk about mikem in a minute. I'm very embittered on account of you. Ki yatzavi ad Adonai, because God's hand has come out against me. In other words, God has punished me. Now, who do we know in the Bible who has experienced that, where God has directly come and taken things away from him, and God seems to be almost like an enemy who's pursuing him? And the answer is Job. Indeed, Job's name, Eov, is a play on the word oyev, enemy, which appears in Job chapter 13. God is his enemy, as it were. And that's who now Naomi speaks. And towards the end of the chapters, we'll see in the next podcast, there are even phrases that seem to be to link Naomi's speech with the book of Job. In any case, she says, Marli meod, this is a Job kind of word, I'm very embittered, mikem. Now what does mikem mean? So it can mean, I'm very embittered on account of you, which is very strange, because why would she be bitter on account of them, unless she's blaming them for her son's deaths, which is something we don't hear at all. Or whether she's just saying it to try to create a false animosity so that they won't be interested in staying with her and they'll leave, because really in their best interest to leave. Or whether she means, Marli miod mikem doesn't mean, I'm very embittered on account of you, but I'm very embittered on behalf of you. In other words, if you were to come with me, you'd have a very bitter life, and I'd feel very bad about it. After all, God has attacked me. You don't want to stay with me. You're only going to have bad things happen to you. I don't want to have that happen. I don't want that on my shoulders. So this is her second speech. So again, to recap, her first speech is very kind and loving, and it's a beautiful farewell, and they refuse to go. The second speech is fiery, is angry, is bitter. It portrays a self-interest on their part, which may be not a self-interest, but a self-directed interest on their part to stick around and wait for children, which is silly and fantastic and ludicrous. And she says, don't do such a thing. And what happens now? Vatisana kolam yatkena. They cried. Oh, they cried again. Vatishak or palachamota. And this is where the chapter splits into two. It's the halfway point. Vatishak or palachamota. Orpa kissed her mother-in-law. What was that kiss? It was a kiss of farewell. I remember I mentioned in the last podcast that the name Orpa is associated with Oref, the back of the neck. At that point, Orpa, of course, is going to turn and say goodbye, and all we will see will be the back of her neck, and that's going to be the end of Orpa in the story. Batishak Orpa lachamota, Orpa kissed her mother-in-law, Verut davkaba, and Rut cleaved to her. Now that va, Verut, it's important to understand it is what is referred to as vav hanigud, or conversive vav. Not the normal conjunction and Ruth, but rather it should be translated as but or rather. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but on the other hand, contradistinctively, Ruth stayed with her. She cleaved to her. She stuck to her. And we don't know what this cleaving is yet, but clearly she did not leave. Now, Naomi has a crowbar. As any parent who has several children of close enough age can testify, whether or not the parent ever says this, there's always the temptation to say this, that when one child is behaving properly, to say to the other child, why can't you be more like your brother who cleans up his room or whatever it may be? Now Naomi has that crowbar because Orpah has done what she asked, which is to leave. Now Ruth stays with her, and Naomi turns to Ruth. What does she say? Batomer, hine shava yivimtech. Interesting. Naomi now refers to Orpah as the Yivama, sort of the sister-in-law of some sort of Ruth. Shavi yimtech el amavi el Eloheha. She's gone back to her nation and to her God. And that is, of course, a very troubling phrase, because that means that Naomi's goal was to have Orpah return to her people and to her worship. But to return to her God makes it sound as if, in the meantime, she'd been worshiping Hashem. Very difficult to understand how this plays out. I don't have any answers. Shuvi achrei vimtech. And again, that word lashuv. She has returned to her nation. You should return after her. Follow her. Go back. Vatomer Ruth al tifkei vi lo zvech lashuv miachareich. And Ruth says, don't bother me. Don't push me to leave you alone. And this is not, this is saying, I'm not going to go, so stop trying. Why? Ki lasher telchi elech. First of all, wherever you go, I will go. Now we get an explanation of Davka. What does it mean that she cleaved to her, she clung to her? She said to her, wherever you will go, I will go. Lasher talini alin, wherever you lodge, I will lodge. In other words, I'm not going to leave you. Wherever you walk, that's where I'm going to go. And wherever you sleep, I'm going to stay there. Amech ami, your nation is my nation. Elohaich Elohai, and your God is my God. In other words, you're not going to push me back to that nation. Because which nation is mine? My nation is your nation. You're not going to push me back to that God, the God of Moab. Your God is my God. Now, this is a phrase which halachically, Masachet Yevamot, Daf Vav, is used as the source of several of the obligations of a potential convert. But in the simple read of the text, what Ruth is essentially saying is, I am clinging to you and through you to everything you stand for, including your nation and your God. That it is the personality of Naomi, the exemplary kindness or great character of Naomi, which has drawn both of these girls to her, and Ruth to the point where she refuses to leave her. And that's what draws her to her God, etc. Parenthetically, we'll get to that in a minute. The Lohayach Lohay. Bashar, in the rest of her statement is, Bashar tamuti amut, wherever you die, I will die. That seems to be belied by the next phrase, Vashamekaver, and I would be buried there. Koyaseh Adonai li v'choyosif, this is a phrase which in this time period of Shoftim and Shmuel is an oath formula. Ki amavit yafrid ben yuvinech. Death alone will separate between you and me. Which is strange, because she just said, where you die, I will die. So evidently what she means is, until you die, I will be with you. And eventually I'll arrange to be buried there, but I am going to be with you at every point of every which way. Parenthetically, is what I want to point out a minute ago, is all the characters in this book, except for the ones who were introduced as foils at the beginning, are good people. Naomi is clearly exemplary and one of the heroines of the book. Ruth, of course, is the heroine of the book. But Orpah is great also. You have to remember, Orpah stayed with her husband for 10 years in Moab. After he died, she remained close to Naomi. She wanted to go back with Naomi. She protested and stayed with Naomi. It was only when Naomi said the final thing that she turned around and left. Ruth is fantastic, but Orpah is great also. It's important to note that, and we'll see a symmetrical piece with two of the men who appear later on in our text. And that's what it says, right? Parenthetically, some of the Protestant marriage rituals utilize vows that are taken exactly from here. Whither thou goest, I shall go, etc., which ends with the famous phrase, till death do us part. But that's exactly a translation of this phrase. And Naomi saw that Ruth was insisting and was stubborn and she was going to walk with her. And so Naomi was quiet. She refused to talk to her anymore. And we'll go a little bit further here, and I'm going to end before the end of the chapter, because the end of the chapter itself is very telling, and there's much to say about it. We'll save that for next week. And the two of them walked until they got to Beit Lechem. But they're walking in silence. Now you're going to see at the end of the chapter, and certainly welcome to look ahead, you will see that the silence turns into an oblivion to the point where Naomi ignores the fact that Ruth is with her at all. For a time being. That we'll see when she arrives in Beit Lechem. But we have to go now into the mind of Naomi. What is it that she's expecting? And this is a phenomenon that we're familiar with, both in literature and life experience, and that is sort of the delayed return. What Rav Samet refers to as Hashiva HaMeucheret. And it's a common theme, both in many different types of literature, of somebody who is going to return home or return to the scene of some important piece of their life from younger years and has all sorts of expectations of what it's going to look like. But then when they get there, they find that the expectation or the memory was one thing and the reality is very different. Here is Naomi, who has been gone for a long time. We don't know how long, but over 10 years. Long enough to leave and be in Moab for a while, and then have her husband die, and then have her husband and her sons get married, and live 10 years and die, and then the famine is over. So it's been a while. She, whatever her memories are, whatever her impression are, is of what Yehuda was like and what it may be like now, are perhaps looming very large and welcoming and warm in her mind, but she's now going to have to face the harsh reality of coming back and seeing what really is there. What is there for a family that abandoned their kinsmen during this time and went to the more productive and more plentiful fields of Moab? What we're going to take a look at next week is the last 3.5 verses of the text. We will then discuss the role of the keyword shuv in the entire parak, the tension that's felt here. And as mentioned, I will link up a chart that will show how the word shuv plays in to this chapter. What we have seen in this chapter so far is two sets of dialogues. The first set of dialogues was a pair of speeches that Naomi had with Orpah and Ruth. The first one is very kind, and the next one, after they said, "No, we're going to stay with you," a very short sentence, is Naomi came back and had a response which was very harsh. At that point, Orpah leaves and Ruth stays. Again, there's a dialogue. Naomi says, go back. Ruth has her response with the 6 commitments. I will stay with you. I will sleep where you sleep. I will die where you die, etc. And at that point, we would expect Naomi to respond again, just as we had in the first half. Here, Naomi's silence is telling. And what happens with somebody who goes into a situation of depression, as we will see in the next set, is both self-absorption and a sense of helplessness. And that is the kind of insularity and insulation that Naomi seems to be expressing with walking all the way from wherever it is that the last conversation happened, all the way to Beit Lechem in silence, to the point that when she gets to Beit Lechem, she's almost ignorant or unaware of the fact that standing next to her is an absolutely loyal young woman who is going to follow her and take care of her till her last day. Mirtz Hashem, we will continue next week. Everybody should have a wonderful Shabbos, and we'll be podcasting on Monday or Tuesday.